Goodbye June is a new family drama starring and directed by Oscar winner Kate Winslet in her directorial debut. It arrives on Netflix this Friday. The film follows four adult siblings who reunite to be with their mother June, played by Helen Mirren, as she faces a terminal illness. Written by Winslet's 21-year-old son Joe Anders, the film is a study of grief, love and family chaos at Christmas. Earlier, I spoke to Kate Winslet about the film. Before we hear from her, we'll take a clip from Goodbye June. Here, June's children catch up on a family phone call to discuss new living arrangements for their mother and father following June's hospitalisation. Timothy Spall plays June's husband Bernie, with Kate Winslet, Toni Collette and Andrea Riseborough as her daughters Julia, Helen and Molly, and Johnny Flynn as her son Connor.
I've never found a better culinary pairing than Guinness and pork scratchings, Connor. I never.
Yeah. Dad, shut up. I can't hear what Helen's saying.
What?
Go on, Helen.
No. If Mum can't go home, she'll have to stay at mine, and that's that.
Do you mean to your house, Molly?
Of course. Who else's?
To stay with her.
Yes, to stay with me,
and then Connor and you and Dad, Helen, can stay with Julia.
Yeah, great, whatever, yeah.
Absolutely fine, that's a very good idea. Plenty of room,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, that's good,
yeah.
Oh my God, how did this even happen?
Dad forgot to turn the taps off.
No, I never did. No, I did.
It is unbelievable. Mercury is in retrograde though, you know that.
Okay, moving on.
What if?
No, Mum's just going to come and stay at mine.
What if? Sorry, going to say this.
No.
We have got the downstairs space with the ensuite and the underfloor heating, so it's very warm.
Really easy. We can fit you in there as well, Dad. That'd be nice. And there's the TV and everything.
Telly, fucking big telly.
You know, it might just be a little bit more.
Yeah, that could work out.
I'd say. What?
Roomy.
Okay. Maybe we can find some kind of happy middle ground.
There is no happy middle ground, Helen.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go now.
Connie, I'll call you back.
Kate, you're very welcome to Arena. This story centres on a family gathering around their mother following a fall at home. Can you give us some sense of who each of these four children and their parents are, and maybe the dynamic between them as well?
I mean, this is a family of grown siblings who, for their own reasons, have, you know, moved away, grown apart. And certainly Molly and Julia have this intense, almost feud going on that involves total silence. So they haven't spoken for years. And poor Connor is the person who's the kind of peacekeeper, and he's quite complicated in himself. You know, he probably has some questions around his own identity that he's never answered. And at the same time, he's got a relationship with his father, who he lives with, where they talk, but they don't communicate at all. They've kind of emotionally flatlined for some time. And this is also a family who are dealing with that sometimes monotony that comes with when a person has a life-limiting illness and is going through treatment and endlessly in and out of those machines and the hospital appointments and the scans and the stuff and the thing. And so establishing that sense of realism around just the routine of it all for all of them, and the kind of tag teaming that has to go on when you're a big family coping with supporting someone who's going through that. You know, they're all in it and yet not really talking about it at all. And I think that's quite true to life. You know, we're rubbish in this country at talking about grief and loss, and yet it's something that we all have to go through. And you know, as much as, yes, of course, it's a film about loss, for me, it's always been much more actually about family and about life and human connection. And this group of siblings come together and are closer because of this loss. And actually, by the end of the film, no matter what, you sort of know that they're going to be okay, and that life goes on. And that is, of course, what happens in life.
The screenplay was written by your son, Joe Anders, and he started writing this when he was 19. So where did he draw these characters from?
I mean, I can't be specific about where he drew the characters from, because that was very much his own invention. But he had experienced, along with myself and the rest of our family, the loss of his grandmother when he was a teenager. And he was always so moved by how we were all able to be there for her. And we were there because we came from this one woman. And so he took that as a sort of emotional backdrop, and from there created this fictional family with a fictional story set at a Christmas, which I really thought was just so genius because, you know, what the Christmas idea gives us is that sense of a clock ticking, momentum of time passing as you creep closer to this one day in the year that everybody becomes very heightened emotionally about, with those siblings simultaneously desperately trying to get to that day so they can give their mother that last Christmas because she loves it, you know. I mean, for me, as the person who ended up directing it, I wasn't originally going to direct it. I was going to produce it and play one of the siblings. But when I realized that we simply couldn't let it go, I think because I had gone through that loss myself of my own mother, it was inevitable that as the director, there were things that I would, you know, compare those situations to and inevitably probably draw from, even though the circumstances were wildly different. And there were also things that were very emotional to scenes that were very emotional for me to direct because my parents were together until my mum died. But I was never in the room when they had any of those private conversations. You know, my father didn't leave her side. So, of course, they would have had those conversations. So sometimes I literally felt like I was watching possible conversations that they might have had playing out before my eyes with Tim and Helen's beautiful performances.
Julia, the character you play here in the film, is balancing a lot of plates. She's balancing family and work and family finances. As an actor and then director and then producer on this film, did you sympathise with her?
Oh, my God. I mean, Julia is like, you know, she's like every working mother I know. So yeah, I could sympathise, I could empathise, I could absolutely relate to that thing. I mean, it's very hard for working women sometimes to even admit that they do love their jobs. I mean, I love my job, you know. It does mean compromise, it does mean sacrifice, and I hate that part of it. But sometimes there's nothing you can do. You just have to roll with those situations and desperately try and compensate and make up for that lost time in other ways. I mean, I've been there. There's things I've missed that I feel horrific about. But that's the case for so many of my friends, people I know, other friends in the industry. And actually, it is something that we don't really express, you know, because people do expect for us to be that strong one who just keeps going and keeps powering through. And, you know, there is this thing about women, especially working mothers. Sometimes you keep going because you have to. You just have to. And that's something that we all as working mums share. So yeah, for definite, I absolutely was able to connect with Julia on that level.
In the midst of all of the noisy chaos of the family within the hospital room, it's frequently the characters that are silent that are telling us most about the emotion in the scenes here. Maybe talk to me a little bit about how you used the camera to convey that to the audience.
I really worked very hard with our cinematographer, Alvin Kuchler, during pre-production. We talked a lot about what mattered to me, and what mattered to me was not loads and loads and loads of coverage, even though we had that when we needed to. What mattered was actually holding my nerve and being really unafraid in the early part of our story to just stand back and observe this group of people in one room or in one waiting room. Because in order to set the tone of distance between those two siblings, discomfort that Connor feels in having to process what's happening to his mother, yes, but also having to deal with all this fucking shit, you know, and how hard it is for him to cope with that. Sometimes placing himself by the window so he can physically be separate. He doesn't want to have to hear it, you know, standing at the hospital door, just too damn scared to walk right to her bedside and be that person. And so holding my nerve and staying loose with the camera in the early third of the film so that you get to feel and see the physical space between these people mattered really a lot. I kept saying to Alvin, you know, we have to earn our close-ups. We can't just do this and this because the cameras are there and we've got all these lovely, delicious lens choices. That doesn't make any sense to me. And so actually, the first time we really go very close on Helen Mirren, like this close on Helen Mirren, is when Connor is reading her that poem. And we, boom, we're right into her face, in her eyes, and you really see that world of anguish that she feels at seeing for the first time her pride in her son, her deep love for her son, the specificity of that connection that they share that is very different to the connection she has with her other children. But also you see what she knows is happening. She knows she's going to go. She knows what she's leaving behind. And actually her ability to hang on to her dignity and hide that from her children. She knows she has complete agency in her own decline because she is well aware of what's happening to her. And keeping that behind closed doors, so making sure that the scenes with Nurse Angel really did feel private and honest in a very, very different way. Actually, for me, I know that that mimics real life. We worked very closely with nurses who work in end-of-life care and palliative care workers so that we didn't get that side of it wrong, because those relationships are so extraordinary and those workers are unbelievable.
Okay, so this is June's room. She's very tired after the operation and still a bit drowsy. She's unlikely to remember everything you're saying, so best to keep things simple for now. There's a buzzer by her bed, and I'm just down the hall if you need me.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, mate. Thank you. June? Junie? Are you all right?
Oh, yeah. Bernard. Oh, Bernard. I tried to get bake off, and the lady said I was to press this button, and when I did it, it just went all black.
See what I can do. I can't make any promises.
Thanks, Bern.
I cared enormously about making sure that there was nothing haphazard about the way I was choosing to shoot it. It had to make sense. Nothing could be indulgent. Nothing could be manipulative. I didn't want to trick the audience. Audiences are clever. And especially with a film about something that is I think, so relatable, you know, I would have been an idiot if I'd ever tried to, like, lay it on too thickly. And I had those brilliant actors. You know, actually, a lot of the time it was about pulling back, you know, reminding everybody, you know, this is a family who doesn't really say a bunch of I love yous. You know, let's not get too comfortable in how much we all love each other as the actors making this film. You've got just keep it. These are words that are hard for them to say. Let, you know, so those constant reminders and also reflecting those emotions with that camera work and not ever doing things for the sake of doing it or trying to be clever. You know, I had to, you know, I just had to say to myself, don't try and be tricksy or artsy. And I would often say to our camera team, no, get the ramp out. That's fucking arty wank shit. We're not having any of that. And everyone would, of course, laugh with me and be like, yeah, of course she's going to have us, like, not try and do the clever thing.
Just perhaps to finish, Kate, it was strange to see Helen Mirren play somebody who at first sight is very frail. She'd said herself that she didn't want to play anybody who was dying or who was with dementia, but she was swayed by you. How did you convince her to play the role?
You know, I didn't convince her. And actually, I'm not the kind of person just in life who would ever try and, you know, actively try and convince someone to do something. So I was just really honest. I spoke to her on the phone. I told her what the story was. I told her it was written by my son. I told her that I was going to direct it. And she then revealed that she has these two rules that she wouldn't break. And I said, "That's okay, that's completely fine. I absolutely respect that. Don't worry. I don't even need to send you the script." And actually it was Helen who said, no, send it to me. I would like to read it. It does sound wonderful. And she read it. And a week later I had this email saying, "Dearest Kate, I will break my rule. This is a wonderful story and I'd love to support you." And that's Helen. That's Helen. She's like the consummate backbone. And she bloody did it, you know. And it was hard for her. It was hard for her. And she did have days where she would say, "I don't like it today. I don't like it. Just tell me. And I'd say, "Okay, fine. Lie down. Don't move your head. Okay, action." She just needed that practicality to kind of just keep her sort of on track. And she also just needed to say it. You know what I mean?
Kate Winslet, it has been amazing to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
You can see Goodbye June on Netflix from this Friday. Now, 50 years ago, an album was released which influenced generations of artists to follow. Discreet Music was producer and musician Brian Eno's fourth album, a minimalist masterpiece of one 30-minute synthesizer piece and three variations of Pachelbel's Canon in D, showcasing the glories of the synthesizer and becoming a pioneering work of ambient music and electronica. Zara Hederman's been listening back to the album. She joins me now with her thoughts on Discreet Music and why it remains one of the best ever produced. Before we do any of that, Zara, let's, for the sake of people who might not know, who is Brian Eno? Bring us back to the early days before this album is released.
Yeah, and kind of shockingly, when we hear what we're about to talk about, he had his beginnings in Roxy Music. Very briefly, from 1971 to 73, he left them and became this just extraordinary glam art rock kind of pioneer with albums like Here Come the Warm Jets in 1974, which then was followed by the likes of Another Green World, which was kind of a dalliance into this kind of more ambient setting. But I suppose he's also best known as like a producer. So he worked extensively with the likes of David Bowie, who was a massive fan of Discreet Music and led to their collaboration. He worked a lot with Talking Heads, with U2, doing the Joshua Tree, Octane Baby, along with Daniel Lanois. And today, even still, like with Coldplay and his protege Fred Again. So he's massive, and his career has just endured across 50 years. He even has released 28 of his own studio albums, Forever and Ever No More, in 2022. And my favourite fact about Brian Eno, and again feeds into this album, he invented the jingle on Microsoft Windows 95. So the synonymous noise that you hear when you would have set your computer up, that was Brian Eno.
He has. He's been on his own Instagram account quite recently talking about that in an entirely different context. Yeah. Okay, so Discreet Music, 1975. It's not his first album, so why is it so important?
Well, it really launched him into ambient music, and I think really established ambient music as a genre that artists became more intrigued by. And without this album, I feel like we have to wonder if we'd have artists like William Baczynski as well, his Disintegration Tapes album, even to the likes of like Aphex Twin. Like, while the music is different, it's a similar kind of loop sensibility. And what this as well was so important for just even establishing Eno's own confidence and assurance to continue in this pursuit. So after this, in 1978, he started his ambient suite and series of albums for like music for film or music for airports, into like loads of different collaborations, both with like John Hassell, Harold Budd. So it was a real big moment for his career. And I think aside from the big production work he's done, it is a lot of the time what people think of when they think of Brian Eno.
Okay, let's clear the decks for a couple of minutes. Let's give people a sense of what this album sounds like before we talk about it anymore. This is the title track from Discreet Music. That is the title track from Discreet Music, which, if in theory we let run, would take us all the way to the very end of the program at 8 o'clock. It's a really interestingly structured album insofar as that's all of side one. Side two is then three different variations of another piece of music. So talk to me about how the album is structured first.
Yeah, so we start off with the title track, which as I said is 30 minutes, but Eno has talked about how that was only a necessity to fit it on one side of a record, that this piece of music essentially could have gone on forever because of the way it was constructed. So basically, and what I loved as well researching this, the liner notes for this album came with a diagram of how it was made, which I really love from Brian Eno, like not gatekeeping the process, like actually showing people, because we also have to remember in 1975, this was a year when we had like ABBA's self-titled track, we had Queen's A Night of the Opera, Blood on the Tracks, like really big overly produced albums. But on this, he talks about how it was a synthesizer plugged into a sequencer, an echo unit and two tape recorders doing like a Frippertronics, which was developed by Robert Fripp of King Crimson, who was another kind of main collaborator of Eno's. So he talks about as well when this was made. Basically, he set all of that up, presumably in his home studio, started the synthesizer, and then throughout the day he was getting phone calls, people were knocking on his door, and he talked about how, and as we listened to it, it's really soothing. And his whole thing with ambient music was that, yes, it's interesting, but it's also ignorable. So you can let it wash over you and it's not going to distract you, because he loved this thing Eric Satie had said, furniture music, which kind of, again, brought him into this world where music shouldn't be an intrusive kind of mode of like art. And we get this here. And as well, he also has talked about automatic music, where, again, he left it all kind of to develop itself.
And the album it just made itself.
And basically, yeah. So side one was very easy to make. And he even said that, like, he didn't really have to listen to it when he was making it.
I always think that maybe does an injustice to albums like this. I know there are a lot of people, and look, I'm one of those people who leaves it on in the background sometimes when you're doing something else or when you're on a car journey. He may have been being slightly, you know, disingenuous when he suggested that, you know, it wasn't really designed to be listened to carefully. I mean, there's a lot of work and effort goes into this, and it is 1975.
Absolutely. And I think for me, listening again to it, this would have been an album I stuck on a lot when I'm working, so it's not going to distract me because there's no lyrics. But we hear there, like, the certain frequencies really do catch you and grab you in. And then I think the first side is really nicely juxtaposed with side B, which is a bit of a shock then after you have that soothing music for 30 minutes. Then we have these three variations of Johann Pachelbel's Canon in D, which Pete Waterman, a huge pop producer, once described as the godfather of pop music in terms of its sequencing and how it's structured and its euphoria. And here Eno got Gavin Bryars, who had composed a piece of music called The Sinking of the Titanic, which is a fascinating piece and also really influential in its own way. It influenced Wise Blood in her 2017 album. So for this, they gathered together a group of session musicians who actually didn't want to be named on the liner notes. So they're known as, I think, the Cockpit Band. And they then were taking their strings, and they had movements within that piece of music that they wanted to deconstruct it. But again, like that with discrete music, there's certain elements that really stand out and strike you and draw you back into the music.
Definitely was not expecting Pete Waterman to be quoted in our discussion about this tonight. Okay, so there are on the second side three variations on Canon in D major by Pachelbel, but there are three very different ones. So I want to play one of them for you here. This is the first of the three. It's called Fullness of Wind. Now, you are still listening to Arena. That is Brian Eno from Discrete Music in 1975. And that's the first of the three variations of Pachelbel's Canon on the B-side. It's called Fullness of Wind. So it is recognisably Pachelbel's Canon, which is one of those pieces of music that you hear layered throughout pop music in the 20th century, and it inspires so many people. But what's he doing with it here?
So what they're doing is they're, because each of these pieces is about 10 minutes again, and what they're doing is drawing them out and making them really elongated and very introspective. And I think what they have talked about, and the thing that they really were excited by, was removing expectation to the listener. So they're like, that there is, and Fullness of Wind, listening to it, I think I've been to many weddings and funerals where this is played. So to hear this crop up here is very unexpected. And then you have something like French Catalogues, again, has that quite elegiac feel to it, because Canon in D is very euphoric. It has such a kind of mood buster element to it. But these really strip back the elements. And then you have like Brutal Larger, which, as a closing track on this album, is so interesting because the shrill of strings in this is really discombobulating, given that we've come from this very soothing space. But again, it's so interesting how they're layering the elements on top of each other. And like with discrete music, like there's two different kind of melodic lines interplaying with each other, but also kind of in competition with each other. So there's so many different layers to these arrangements without your really comprehending that because they seem so sparse and so minimal and so form focused on one particular element.
Do you think he's inspiring other composers down the decades? I'm thinking about in particular, you know, we're just talking about Max Richter's variation on the Four Seasons, which again is an incredibly well-known set of pieces of music, but which he does something quite similar with in terms of deconstructing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like listening to this as well, like I mentioned William Baczynski earlier, I think that's an integral influence. Max Richter, absolutely. And I feel like there's a cinematic kind of twist to these two. Like, I feel like there has to be so many film composers that heard this initially and were very inspired by it.
So at what point was Brian Eno in his career in December 1975? Where is he?
Well, quite literally, he's in a hospital bed. So he had been in an accident where he was knocked down by a taxi cab and he was bedbound for an extended period. And as I mentioned beforehand, the previous solo albums are really big. They're really theatrical, glam rock kind of expressions. So to hear this very tempered mode is very much reflective of the limitations that he had within his own body at the time. Like, this album came about because his friend Judy Nylon came over and she gave him a record of like 18th century harp music, and that, because he was in bed, he actually couldn't turn it up. So there was a time when it was lashing rain and he couldn't hear it, but he also couldn't do anything about it. So in hearing that album in particular, that really inspired him, and he says like made him listen to music in a completely new way. So that new evaluation and appreciation for music stems from a very unfortunate accident that he had had.
Okay, let's have a listen to the second track on the B-side of this album. Again, it's a variation on Pachelbel's Canon, but this one's called French Catalogues. So, still recognisably the same piece of music, but also not the same piece of music. Why do you think that Eno at that point was so interested in Pachelbel's Canon that he wanted to turn it into three different variations on one side of this album?
I think because of the familiarity people had with it, so the expectation kind of element to it is really integral to that. But also I think he was really interested in stripping away its functionality and also just deconstructing it, but also bringing to a wider audience what ambient music could be, because he even had been listening to ambient music for about a decade before. He'd loved Steve Reich, he loved Charlemagne Palestine, who's a pianist, but he also loved Lamont Young. And all of the ideas of what ambient music to that point had been was this really discordant, unpleasant kind of style of music. But he's actually showing here, and especially with this piece of music, which is perfect for it, that you can have ambience, you can have space, you can have minimalism, but not forego traditional melodies and hooks to it and familiarity, which I think is crucial to why this album is so influential and so important today.
Because ambient music today is something that's widely known, widely acknowledged. If you wanted to open your streaming service of choice, you would find tens of thousands of albums, but some worth listening to, some not worth listening to. Where is ambient music in 1975? Because it's still kind of in its sort of popular infancy.
Yeah, it's very much an outlier. As I said, like, you had in 1975, everything was produced up the wazoo. Like, it was very theatrical, it was very big, and it more so had a kind of live reputation where you had to go and see it, as opposed to it wasn't really something that you could have at home. And I think as well, like, with working on this album and making it and listening to the 18th century harp music, Eno said as well he had a real appreciation for Muzak and just like how music can be a component and an unintrusive element within a room. So that I think was hugely important for making this style of music a bit more accessible. And as I said, having that diagram as well, he's inviting people into this world. He's showing people how it's done. And I really, really appreciate that it wasn't something that he was holding to himself, because as we've said, and as you've mentioned, it's still so popular today. Like, you even have playlists on streaming platforms that are just like ambient study beats and stuff like that. And it is like always my favorite, I think, type of music to listen attention to, because it allows you that space of tuning out and focusing on something that is kind of pressing like work, but also appreciating someone's artistic ambition. And even if that ambition is something that's quite tempered, it's still really beautiful.
It would feel like a shame if we didn't play the third variation from the other side of the album. So this is the one that finishes off the album. It's called Brutal Ardour. And that's the third variation of Pachelbel's Canon, B-side of Discrete Music, the Brian Eno album. That's called Brutal Ardour. In terms of the listening experience of the album now, as opposed to 50 years ago, obviously it's been remastered in the intervening time, but people listen to music differently as well. It is a very different experience now than it would have been initially when it came out on vinyl in 75.
Yeah, it's definitely less shocking, I feel, now than it would have been then. And I do agree, like, with this album, I have listened to it mostly on headphones, and it is something I have to consciously put on. But I'm also really grateful to it, because I feel like music now, again, we've kind of that return of, like, it's a big pop moment. There's huge production. There's a lot of lyrics and songs. And I just really appreciate this for the moment of quiet it provides. And funnily, before I left the house today, I had it on speakers. And it is a completely different thing, where it's actually a bit more, especially side B, is a lot scarier than it is maybe on headphones, when you're kind of just intimately there in the space. And when it's there out within a room, it's a lot more imposing, I guess, at some points, especially Brutal Ardour. I find that quite scary. But I also love with this, and I appreciate with this, the return to, like, hearing things like the tape hissing on, like, Discrete Music. But then on Brutal Ardour, it kind of begins with almost the sounds of tape rewinding. So it's those little details as well that I look out for as someone listening to it today that we don't always get in contemporary recordings.
Unlike a lot of his contemporaries at the time in 1975, Brian Eno is still very, very relevant and very cool, isn't he?
Yeah, like, his protege is Fred Again, who, when he played in Dublin a couple of weeks ago, there was a frenzy for people to try and get tickets to it. And like that, he's someone who doesn't really feed into his own importance. I feel like he does welcome collaborating with a lot of younger generations like Fred Again. And it's great to see him kind of shepherding all of these new artists to continue this mode of music.
Well, you should seek it out. The album is Discrete Music, and we've been talking about the 50th anniversary of it. Zara Hedeman, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
The Brimming World is a new collection of essays from the late poet, musician, writer and translator Ciarán Carson. The collection spans 5 decades of writing, which brings alive Ciarán's curiosity and intelligence. And its editor, Gail McConnell, who counted Ciarán as a mentor and friend, joins me now on the line. Gail, you're very welcome to tonight's Arena.
Thank you so much. Lovely to be here.
I want to start with the title, Gail, The Brimming World. It's a reference to poetry. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, absolutely. So this comes from a passage that Ciarán loved to translate. Translate so much, he translated it multiple times. It comes from Shauna Reardon, and it's from, I'll read a little bit. This is a question that he asks the book, "Where is poetry?" And the answer is supplied in this way. "The mind of a child. Imagine two people in a room, a child and his father, and a horse going on the street outside. The father looks out and said, 'There's Mary's horse going past.' That is a narration. It would seem the father loses the horse because he remains outside of it. Say a horse is a disease. The father doesn't catch the disease. The horse doesn't enrich the father's life, but the child. The child empathizes with the sound of the horse. He savors the sound of the horse for the sake of the sound itself, and he listens to the sound grow dim, diminishing, until it recedes into silence, and he wonders at both sound and silence. And the world brims with horse amazement and canter magic." So this is the phrase, "the world brims," which he translates in another place as "the world then blooms." And this is Ciarán's sense in a translation of what poetry is. Poetry is like the mind of the child, that incredible imagination for whom the world is full of magic, full of wonder, full of amazement. And this is what poetry at its best can do and can bring. But also, you know, the brimming world is really that overflowing, full running past the lit place of Kieran's imagination. You know, there was nothing that wasn't of interest to Kieran. Poetry, music, literature, visual arts, photography, traditional music, everything and anything, large and small, human and non-human, nothing was beyond his curiosity. And so the brimming world is the imagination of this wonderful man. And it's a collection of 48 essays that sort of articulate some of his many enthusiasms and obsessions and interests, part memoir, part essay, some reviews, a whole mixture of things, but something that hopefully brings new and longtime readers into the brimming world of his imagination.
In terms of this collection itself, you started it with Kieran when he was ill. He died from complications from lung cancer in 2019. Maybe just tell us how that whole process came about.
Yeah, well, I suppose Kieran would probably say it came about through happenstance in a way, and it came about through conversation. You know, many of us remember that time of 2019 when Kieran very sadly had a terminal diagnosis, and he knew he only had months to live, but he was also writing the most astonishing poems of his career, some of the finest poems in the language, the book that became Still Life, this incredible collection of poetry about painting, but a poetry about life and death, which sadly he didn't live long enough to see launched when we launched it in Belfast in the Great Hall in October of 2019. He had died just prior to that. But during that period, you know, he was sending out these poems to us, and I began to talk with Kieran and say, you know, somebody really should gather up your essays. And, you know, we know Kieran the translator, we know Kieran Carson the prose writer, we know Kieran Carson the poet, the musician, you know, these many selves, but actually we were yet to see a collection of essays. And, you know, I was conscious that people like Seamus Heaney and Paul Muldoon and many other poets had published essays. And I felt strongly that there should be a book of essays by Kieran Carson in the world. And so I just began to chat with him and say, you know, who should edit that book, and what would be in that book? And we began to talk about it a little bit. And then I thought to myself after some time, well, you know, it might as well be me. I want to make sure that it comes into the world. And so I offered to do it. And Kieran spoke with Peter Fallon at Gallery Press, who have published this beautiful book for us. And Peter was, of course, enthusiastic about the prospect, even though he was still busy trying to get, Still Life into print, and it was still being written at the time. But Kieran then started to send me some pieces. He sent me in particular a lot of the third section of the book, which is a sequence of essays, really, that were initially published in the Journal of Music. And they're all essays, short pieces, wonderful, lively, rich pieces about playing music, collaboration and the small back room and reels and jigs and the whole history of music and storytelling, really, and collaboration that he loved, and that was such a big part of his life, from his time as traditional arts officer in the Arts Council of Northern Ireland from 1975, from the decades he spent playing with Deirdre, his wife, and the amazing, you know, passion that they shared for music. So he sent me a lot of those pieces and directed me to the Emery Archive, where a lot of his materials were catalogued, so that I could, you know, begin to familiarise myself with quite the range. I don't think Kieran ever really knew quite how many essays he'd published. And the truth of it is, we could have had a book three times the size because he was, you know, he wrote, I don't know how he did it, but in addition to everything else that he managed to publish in his lifetime, he published a lot of essays and a lot of reviews, and so tracking them all down took me a little bit of time. But it was a joy to talk with him about the prospect, and he was very keen that music and literature would be represented, that there'd be some interleaving of those interests, but that maybe the music section would be a discrete section of its own. So that's what we've come up with in a book that's in three parts. The first are, you know, substantial essays on literature, on painting, on photography. The middle section on reviews of writing in Irish and in English, poetry, prose, biography, American poets that he loved. And then the third section, the elsewhere, that is music, which is the series of pieces on music. So I'm so delighted that it's, you know, it's finally, yeah, arrived in the world. And I just wish that Kieran was here to correct all my errors and tell me the things he would have done differently.
I'd like to talk to you about some of those essays. For those who know Kieran's work as a poet, they'll recognise familiar themes here. He writes about childhood and politics in Northern Ireland and music and art. But for those who don't know his work, maybe you'd read a little something from us and talk about one of the essays that gives us a sense of the colour and evocation of place, maybe Belfast frescoes.
Yeah, I'd love to read from Belfast Frescoes. And it's all about colour, actually. And one of the things about this book as well, The Brimming World, is that really it is, there's memoir in here as well as essays. And this is one of those pieces of just very evocative and rich memoir. So I'll read a little bit from this. Belfast Frescoes. Back in the 50s, I'd look forward to October or November when every other day smog would permeate and cloak the still dark morning streets with various murks of yellow. Outspan orange, saffron, Coleman's mustard, burnt sienna, honey, jaundice, lentil, nicotine. Snug in the lull between waking and getting up, I'd massage the cool tip of my nose, thinking of it being pressed against the opaque window pane. Outside, the habitual metronome of the blind man's cane was dulled and thickened by the intervening blanket as he made his way to work in the basket factory. His ticks were talks, zigs became confused with zags, and I would savour with a slow, advanced deliberation the prospect of being lost on the way to school. After breakfast, muffled in my overcoat and balaclava, I would step into the incandescent wall of coal smoke smog. I'd inhale its acrid aura through my woolen mouthpiece. I step into the sudden fug of the classroom radiator warmth. When we take the bottles out, they're frozen solid halfway down their half pint length. We rack and clunk them up like snowman soldiers on the regimental cast iron pipes. Gradually, a sour sweet thaw will blend its milk aroma with the other fug ingredients, chalk dust, pencil shavings, plasticine, sweaty damp raincoats, school bag leather, pencil boxes, the exhalation of our breath against the De La Salle brothers' blackboard black soutien. Snow, too, is in the air. It will soon snow down algebra. We will watch. Crowd the window, then settle down to write in red and blue lined exercise books. I think I even might have left a line of listing out there, all these evocative, amazing lists, these sensory experiences and this valuing of the child self and what the child sees in the world, all those sensory impressions, the snow, which is, you know, literary, it's Joyce's snow, it's McNeice's snow, it's Kieran's snow. It has all of these wonderful connotations over the page. We have snow and tinsel glittering in the shop windows. But there's this just extraordinary attentiveness to the world and this desire to record it faithfully and to be amazed by it. And there's such joy in these essays. The Brimming World is a joy by someone who took pleasure in the world that was given and paid so much attention to it in the small and large things.
I'm interested in his fascination with language. He was a translator. We get a real sense of his relationship with the Irish language, though, in the Horse's Mouth essay, because he wasn't allowed to speak English at home growing up, was he?
This is it. So he talks, you know, from the opening essay and in The Horse's Mouth about being reared bilingually and the sense of Irish being, was it his first, was it his second? Something of both languages and always the sense of being betwixt and between. There's also a wonderful piece about his father's passion for Esperanto. His father joined a group and tried to learn Esperanto, and there's this sort of dream of the common language, Esperanto meaning one who hopes. So Kieran has always been interested in that sense of what is unique to a language, working in and within a language, the confines of it, how it shapes your imagination, and what it is then to translate oneself and to move between languages and indeed then between the whole systems that they kind of bring into view. So that sort of variety, plurality, again, there's that kind of sense of the brimming world of language and of translation. And in some ways, translation is the great subject of this book, actually. It's all the way through these essays, whether he's writing about his own act of translation, translating Dante, for example, or whether he's writing about poetry that's in Irish, as with Biddy Jenkinson, or whether he's writing about the translations that happen through Ekphrasis, poems about paintings, or Derek Madden's adaptations, or whether he's thinking about that experience of the childhood home and his father and the multiple languages of his domestic sphere. Translation is always there. And in a way, he talks about poetry itself as being a kind of translation. We get that in the very first essay. He says, poetry itself is itself translation, carrying a burden of meaning from one place to another, feeling it change in shape and weight as it travels. So there's always that sense of his curiosity in moving between things and moving between states that was the gift, really, of his childhood experience in two languages.
Maybe you'd read a little of The Horse's Mouth for us.
The Horse's Mouth. Where should I go with this? Let me see. Well, that actually, I started out there with the horse's mouth, with that section really about the child empathizing with the sound of the horse. And he talks in this about, English was banned at home, so I must have picked it up from the street. As dusk came on, I would lie awake listening to the sounds of the street, children who were allowed to stay up later than me, skipping, running, chanting, playing hide and seek or war games. Sometimes I'd hear a horse pass by, drawing a rumbling, empty coal cart or a brewer's dray, and I would say the word horse over to myself, savouring its strangeness. And then he goes on to think about the Irish word and the English word for cobble and how these things are sort of all lodged in the mind, and saying these things over and over and thinking, what is the meaning kind of within them? And then moving later on in the essay into the experience of writing the poem Swap, and then of translating Dante's Inferno, and just the variety and possibility in the acts of translation. There's a wonderful essay on Derek Madden, the Fantastic News, where he talks about writer's block and writes about this very common experience really of being a writer and knowing how to get things going, facing the blank page. And he speaks about translation, the gift and joy of translation in that sense, as being a way through that writer's block and a very necessary one, and of sort of finding voice in the act of translation. You know, he praises Madden's raw material and translations of other poets, in which he actually hears, you know, the authentic sort of voice of Madden, but in the act of translation. So it's all the way through these remarkable essays. I feel that we must hear a little bit from the third section too, perhaps from the opening section on music, because as I say, there is real joy in the way that he writes about traditional music and his experience of playing with Deirdre, and the elsewhere that his music opens us with this wonderful piece in praise of the Cayley Band. Have we got a little minute to hear a bit of it?
We have a whole minute for you, if that's what you need. Please,
all right.
Do.
Let me. This has to be heard. This is the brimming world in essence. In praise of the Cayley Band, there's a burst of applause before the band launches into a set of reels. The pace is immediately fast and furious, and you can hear the audience in the background whooping and hurrahing above an excited buzz of conversation. I can't see the lineup, but I'd guess two fiddles, two flutes, accordion, drums, and piano. Nor can I be sure if there are dancers. It's sometimes difficult to tell drums from feet, but it sounds like a squad of them out there or in there, the dance floor thonged and heaving and bouncing as the band carries them along with the music. The band ends the first tune with a coordinated bang and a split-second stop cut of pregnant silence that jump-starts them into the next. A great cheer goes up, impelled by the general excitement. The pace quickens a little, but not too much. Steady as she goes, no need to lose the run of yourself. They're keeping great time for all that. They're pushing the envelope, and they're flying now, full steam ahead. They play the second tune just twice, then they do that stopgap launching pad trick again, bang, before they hammer into the last tune, a very old favourite, The Maid Behind the Bar. And the crowd is going wild now, and my left foot, the one not on the accelerator, is beating dangerous time on the rubber mat of the car floor, my fingers tapping the steering wheel as we drive along the banks of Loch Earn the morning after the night before. It's pure joy, the kind of music that makes you want to get up and dance. Out of the corner of my eye, I catch the eye of my passenger, my wife. She's grinning from ear to ear with pleasure. The set of tunes ends and there's a great roar of applause, whoops and hollers. Great music, I say. It's real music, says Deirdre.
We definitely needed to hear that, and it's a gorgeous collection of essays, and it's been brilliant to talk to you tonight. Gail McConnell, thanks for joining us on Arena.
Thank you so much.
The Brimming World, selected essays from 1975 to 2014, written by Kieran Carson and edited by Gail McConnell, is published by Gallery Press.